Hello, this is Shel Horowitz from transformpreneur.com, and I'm here with Michael Schumann, author of the new book, The Local Economy Solution, and many, many other books. Michael, thank you for joining us here.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, so let's just plunge in. You make a case very clearly in the book that the traditional, quote-unquote, attract and retain style of economic development in which a government recruits large entities from elsewhere with all sorts of tax credits and other incentives is a failure. Why don't you start by telling us why?
So about 5-10 years ago, a great scholar named Ann Morkison from the University of Minnesota pulled together a group of other academics who are specialists in economic development. And some are supportive of this attract and retain model. Some were critical of it. Some were in between. And they decided to really look critically at what it accomplished. And their conclusion was that it was a complete failure. That for the most communities are really losers in these deals. They never get the deals in the first place. And even for the winners, the problem is that you never look at the opportunity costs. What could you have done for the same or less money had you supported your local businesses? And my argument is that if you look carefully at those opportunity costs, you realize that the cheaper, fastest, most effective way of generating jobs and economic development is to nurture one's locally owned businesses.
Okay, and yet the traditional attract and retain strategy not only doesn't help the local businesses, it actually hurts them because it makes an uneven playing field. Those companies that have built up from their bootstraps don't get the subsidies. Why do we do it this way?
Well, I think the reasons why we continue to be addicted to attract and retain are really twofold. One is that, you know, word has circulated slowly to the economic development departments of the world, but let's just say this country, that this is a poor way of doing economic development. But I would say on top of that, is the press that economic developers receive from all of this. So it turns out that, you know, if you announce that you have like a new attraction with 1,000 jobs, you are page one news. But in fact, if you are, you know, get the same number or more jobs in 1Zs, 2Zs, 5Zs, and 10Zs, you're back of the business page. So this is the dilemma. And economic developers, you know, afraid for their jobs, go for the big fish.
So in other words, economic developers really need to understand how to market themselves effectively when building up lots of small organizations rather than bringing in one big one.
Well, that's right. But I really think that the burden sort of falls on us at the grassroots level is to do more and more economic development ourselves so that we don't need to rely on this archaic profession. Because I feel like if you rely on them, you're probably going to come up with the wrong answer.
So let's look at some hard numbers. Give us an example of what a typical attract and retain project actually costs per job created, and then what small business, local existing small business could create, how much it costs them.
Right. So I have in my book an example that I thought was interesting from Sarasota, Florida, which ironically is the home of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And in a way, the story I'm going to tell you talks about the circus of economic development. So I was there, I don't know, about 15 months ago, talking for a local food event there. And someone dropped the local newspaper into my lap, and the headline talked about that the Economic Development Department had done nothing over the previous year, and this was 10 full-time people, had done nothing except try to get a Danish pharmaceutical company called Xellia to come to Sarasota. And they had put on the table a deal that of $137 million of public money that they were paying to get this company to locate in Sarasota. Now, you'd think that $137 million would get you a couple thousand jobs, but in fact, it was only going to get them 191 jobs. And most of those jobs would be filled by individuals who would be moving to Sarasota from someplace else. Now, this is kind of insane, if you think about it, in a couple of different ways. It's the same, first of all, because it works out to about $700,000+ per job. And at that level, you could put that money into a low-risk bond fund and pay a family of four a living wage in perpetuity and never need to worry about the corporation. The second thing that it underscores is just how insane it is to spend that much money when we have good documentation that local economic development can create jobs for $500, $1,000, $2,000 per job. And I give an example in my book of an economic developer, a one-man show in Appalachian, West Virginia, named Lou Stein, who was, you know, for about 5 years was creating 300 to 500 jobs per year at $500 a job. And what was he doing to do this? Well, he would basically assemble people who wanted to create new startups and roll up his sleeves and work with them to do, you know, help them create business plans and introduce them to needed financial institutions. And then for established businesses, he knocked on their doors and did something that the local economic development department apparently never does, which is to ask, how can I help? Mm-hmm. And it's really just these very simple things that one can do to create jobs that can meaningfully impact your economy. And none of us should be wasting our time on these highfalutin attractions.
Yeah, and then I believe in the book you said that Sarasota actually failed to bring home the bacon with its expenditure of $137 million. It wasn't enough. But that 10 people were working full-time on this for, you said, over a year?
Yes, to bring and they lost out to a community in North Carolina. And North Carolina has been one of the biggest pork barrel states in the country, and their economy has suffered terribly because of it.
Now, this is also, this kind of analysis holds true not just for manufacturing, but also for things like sports arenas.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there are some cases of big public infrastructure projects that I think do have payoffs. And so I don't want to condemn all public works projects. But I think it's particularly dumb to do this when you bring in outside contractors to do the work to build these things, and then you bring in outside contractors to run the activities inside of them. And if you look, for example, at football, all but one of the NFL teams is run by a single obnoxious individual who is happy to drop the team and move somewhere else, as we recently saw in St. Louis. The one exception is the Green Bay Packers, which is a community stock-held team. It's been that for almost 100 years. And the fact that it is community-owned means that there will never be a Baltimore or a Los Angeles Packers. And so when a community has ownership in these public works projects and in the activities and entities that are swept up in these projects, then I think it might make sense to put public money into it.
Yeah, interestingly enough, the Green Bay Packers may also be the only sports team to be named after a working class trade that was endemic to that community. I believe the Packers they were named for.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You know, you have other people like the Giants are named after animals like the Broncos. It's you know, you don't have like the don't know, the Detroit Machinists or anything like that.
Right. The Tulsa Teamsters. Yeah, it doesn't happen.
So, this is kind of an arcane career. How did you get into this?
Well, I guess one way of looking at it is that I have been methodically trying to avoid the practice of law ever since I graduated from law school in 1982. But I immediately set up a nonprofit called the Center for Innovative Diplomacy with two other people, and we tried to do our best to get cities and citizens directly involved in foreign policy. And we had a magazine called the Bulletin of Municipal Foreign Policy. And I did that for about 10 years. And then I got interested in how to apply the tools of municipal foreign policy to things like economic development and North-South development cooperation. And I ultimately concluded that economic development really needed a total makeover. And I was reluctant to work internationally on this topic until I got it right in my own backyard. So that set me off on a journey of trying to develop theory and practice around local economic development, starting with a book called Going Local, which was published in 1998, and then three other books that have followed.
Yeah, I've certainly heard of the Small Mart Revolution, which is one of yours. This is actually the first of yours I've actually read, although I've certainly read some articles over the years by you, this local economy solution. So one of the other arguments, actually before I go there, let me back up to something you just said. I happen to live right next to Amherst and Northampton, Massachusetts, two towns known for injecting foreign policy into local issues. Let me draw you back to early years here and talk about what is and isn't appropriate for a local community to be taking on global challenges like that.
I think it's appropriate for a locality to take on anything it wants. And in fact, I would argue that foreign policy is far better executed at the local level than at the national level. And in fact, there's a good new book. I think it was done by, was it Ben Barber, about what if mayors ruled the world, which talks about the very fact that local governments do not have military apparatuses, except for the oddball ones, means that they approach problem solving from a much more constructive and nonviolent angle. And that means that on many, many global issues, environmental issues and economic issues and issues of democratization, you know, sharing best practices among communities is really the best approach to problems. I mean, so even when you talk about climate change, you know, I'm happy all the countries came together in Paris, and I'm happy they made some declarations about their intentions, and I'm happy it got some press. But at the end of the day, all the implementation is going to be done at the local level. And getting cities to share their best ideas about energy efficiency and about how to reabsorb carbon and re-greening efforts and how to change transportation and housing systems, this is what's going to save the planet.
Great. Okay. So one of the other ways in which you are a heretic, and I love heretics, I'm a heretic too, is that you have the idea that the businesses benefiting from economic development organizations should actually be paying for them.
Yes.
So this talk about why this isn't the usual conventional wisdom and how you go about selling something to somebody when they think they can get it for free.
Right. Well, I mean, there's many layers of questions in there, and yeah. And I mean, the first thing that's important to me is for cities to stop doing things that don't work, and convincing them to stop spending, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars on these pointless attractions, I think is an easy win, and so we've already talked about some of the rationales for that. But the next level of the question, which is, well, on top of that, you know, you as an economic development department should try to turn yourself into a self-financing entity. I guess I would. It's less about businesses paying for it, and more about the economic developers, both public and private, seeing themselves as offering a valuable good and service and trying to make it more attractive so that businesses see, you know, like any good thing, any good product out there, they see the value of getting it. And I think, you know, we've seen as one example, and I have this example in my book, that, you know, there's something like 1,000 incubators in North America. And the idea of incubators is to provide a space where businesses can locate, get services, they're nurtured by peers and mentors, and then after 3 or 4 years, they are able to fly away out of the incubator and live happily ever after. Well, almost all these incubators live off of public money. Sometimes private foundation money, sometimes university money, which means that in bad times, when you most need these incubators, they get defunded or budgets get slashed. And so I've been interested in the small number of incubators that actually are self-financing. And so one of the ones that I wrote about in the Local Economy Solution is called Fledge. It's based in Seattle. It mostly focuses on mission, social mission-oriented businesses. And Fledge brings these businesses to its quarters, which is the Impact Hub in Seattle, and works with them intensely, not for 3 years, but for about 3 months. It actually pays these businesses to come onto the site and work with them. But there is a catch. And at the end of those 3 months of incubation, Fledge takes a couple of percentage points of ownership within the company. Now, to put that in perspective, when a venture capitalist works with a company like this, usually they assume something between 51 and 100% of the ownership of the company.
I'm just going to switch us off
video here. And then they ultimately take control, get rid of the management. Whoops.
Yeah, I did that on purpose because you were breaking up. You might want to turn off. Well, you can try it with your video on, but the sound got better immediately when I did that.
Okay. Should I go back a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, so you were talking about Fledge and taking an ownership stake, a small ownership stake versus a large one in a VC.
Right. So you know, in contrast, a venture capitalist will take somewhere between 51 and 100% of the company. They will ultimately get rid of the local management, and if the company succeeds, they will take it public and destroy public ownership. If it fails, if it just has a, you know, positive but not very large rate of return, they may shut the company down. And this is why venture capital is so bad for local businesses. But what Fledge does, you know, it takes a couple of percentage points, and then it gives the company the opportunity to buy back that ownership stake over the next few years by paying a small royalty fee on its gross revenues. And it's a really nice model. Fledge has absolutely no shortage of companies that want to take advantage of this model. Because in the long run, a little bit of, you know, giving up a little bit of equity stake as a way of getting a tremendous boost in your business seems like a very good deal. That, to me, is the kind of arrangement that businesses ought to be rising up to. And I don't think businesses will have much problem with this. And, you know, throughout my book, I give 28 examples of economic development programs that are structured like this. And once they structure themselves properly, businesses are kicking down the door to participate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you're one of the real strengths of your book, and to me, as somebody who's not that familiar with all the financial models is you've got a whole chapter on how to finance this stuff, and it's a really good chapter. And, you know, it's interesting because in my own new book, Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World, one of the things I look at is the bottom of the pyramid customer, the one who has really no disposable income whatsoever. They're living on $20 a month in some developing country. And there are companies that are making good profit selling stuff to these bottom of the pyramid, no disposable income consumers, but they're doing it in ways that don't distress the customer financially. For example, there are a number of companies making solar-powered LED lanterns, and they sell them to people who have been using kerosene. And so the $2 a month they were paying for kerosene goes toward a time payment on the lantern, and then in 10 months or whatever, it's paid off and they own it. So there's no dislocation of money that is needed to bring in food and keep the roof over their heads. And if it can be done with that kind of a population that really has nothing, it's certainly no reason it can't be done with marginal but functional small businesses. That leads me to another question. You as a consultant, and I have many, many consultants in my tribe, you have consulted to very, very tiny businesses and community organizations and also great big multinationals. One of the things I wonder about is how do you structure pricing so it's equitable for somebody whose your entire annual income is soda money versus someone for whom your hourly fee for 2 or 3 hours is going to be a hardship?
Right. I keep struggling to try to get this right, which is why
me too.
Actually I will happily read your guerrilla marketing book to learn from it. My habit is to always undercharge and over deliver, which has not been good for my lifestyle or my finances. So I need to clearly do something different. I mean, what I tend to do is I for speaking, I mean, I have two different rates, one for for-profits, one for non-profits, and then for consulting, it's more or less the same thing. And, you know, I figured out some sort of bottom line that I really need to keep myself alive, and beyond that, I very rarely will give things away because I just can't afford it. But you know, for the bigger clients, yeah, I'll charge the fuller freight. And really, at the end of the day, you know, my own model is that speaking is the best way of paying for the rest of my work. Because, you know, for a relatively small amount of time, I'll get paid for a couple of days' work, and the rest of that time around those days, I can be working on other projects. So that's the effective model. Now my secret is out. Yeah.
And what sorts of groups do you find are willing to hire you to speak?
I do about 30 to 40 speaking events a year. They tend to be business groups or economic development agencies that are, you know, struggling with the existing model or already there and in alignment with a new way of doing business. I sometimes speak to, you know, environmental or grassroots organizations, groups of educators, universities, chambers of commerce, local government associations. I'm going in about a week and a half to Melbourne, and speaking primarily to economic development organizations there. I do a lot of work in Canada. I'm about to start doing work in the United Kingdom. So one of the nice things about the universe of work I do is it's all around community, and there's communities everywhere. So, you know, once you've kind of saturated in one place, you got to find community somewhere else. And I would say that economic development is being done universally in the wrong way. So there's always a ready audience for this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the other things that I like about the book very much is that you look at different models for doing the same thing. For example, let's just say a food delivery service. that are somewhat situational. They work well in one community for one set of reasons and not so well in other places, but a different model will work in that other place. And that's something I also talk about in Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World, particularly as it relates to design with biomimicry principles.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's very difficult to give cookbook formulas. And, you know, so another area that I would talk about is say, buy local programs. And, you know, most buy local programs are done strictly through government grants or foundation grants, you know, to put signs on the sides of buses and have public debates and labels. And even one of the organizations that, you know, I helped found, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, reports that it's 80 members, half of the of those 80 members, the average member is 50% reliant on outside funding, which to me is a tremendous disappointment and a tremendous vulnerability in these organizations. So it's important to figure out other models for self-financing by local programs. And so I talk about a debit card in San Francisco. I talk about a loyalty card in Portland. I talk about a gift card in Edmonton, Alberta. I talk about web-based programs, advertising programs that are being done by a company called Shop City that's based in 25 Canadian cities. I talk about things that are focused in particular sectors like food, and a good example of that would be the edible magazines, which exist in about 85 markets around the United States. So it's important, yeah, to look at these various models of coming at the same problem, because at the end of the day, you know, the dog of philanthropy-supported social change will not hunt. It will exist for a year or two, and then the funder changes his or her mind, has something else for breakfast, thinks of another great priority, and you're dead in the water unless you have a business model. So in my view, and I say this to all Bali networks who are, or all other buy local or local business networks who are watching this, think of a public grant or a foundation grant the way that Bill Clinton told us to think about welfare. It is a second chance. It is not a way of life. Mm-hmm. And you've got to invest that into a long-term self-financing entity.
And wean yourself out of the subsidy. Yeah, well, here in the Pioneer Valley of Massachusetts, which I know you're familiar with and where I happen to live, we have an enormously successful buy local program run by a group called CISA, and they are an independent trade association. I'm sure they must have some government grants in their mix, but they're basically member supported. And the local restaurants and the local farms that are their core members have really shifted the buying consciousness, at least around food. And our Bali affiliate, Pioneer Valley Local First, is trying with considerably less success to shift the conversation on other kinds of purchasing. But the food program, everywhere you go, you see the I'm a local hero farmer. We get our food from local hero farms. And it's I think, one of the most successful initiatives in the country.
Yeah.
And as I said, if government funding is a factor, it's not certainly the main factor in their business model.
Right. Right. No, and you're right that the Pioneer Valley has been a leader in this local food movement. And the movement is now all over the country, all over the world even. And I think it is a great entry point to get into other forms of local business support. But I feel like the Pioneer Valley Bali is also an example of a network out there that cannot possibly support its work just on membership dues. Mm-hmm. It really does need to embrace one of these other tools as a way of supplementing that revenue source in order to do more work. So maybe it sets up a local investment fund, or maybe it sets up a local loyalty card, or maybe it does a joint purchasing network so that all of its businesses have cheaper supplies and cheaper inputs. These are the kinds of things that will prompt members to actually pay more dues and to encourage more people to join.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I think right now the only thing they've really got besides the membership dues is selling ads in the directories. And that's fair. That pays for the directory, but it doesn't pay for program operations.
Right. And actually, so I have, when in my buy local part of the book, the first business model that I talk about is a directory and several other models of directory. And most places have concluded that directories, which can, you know, really are some contain coupons, and the attraction of the coupons is often what encourages people to buy the directory. That model has been pretty much shattered by Groupon and social mm-hmm. living, because mm-hmm. people feel like, well, what's the point of spending money for like a, you know, a 10% discount that I can use once, when I can get, you know, 40, 50% discount through Groupon or social living. And so the whole model doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah, although I think that'll be somewhat temporary, because the Groupon model really doesn't make that much sense for, it makes a lot of sense for Groupon and for the consumer, but fairly little sense for the merchant. The massage therapist who is now discounting by really 75% because 50% off to the Groupon customer, and then half of that goes to Groupon. So it's not really a viable long-term sustainable model for these small, tiny shops to be attracting businesses. And I think there's going to be some withdrawal from that, because there'll be people like, oh, I want a massage. I'll see who's on Groupon this week.
Right. There's right. No, well, it's limited. I mean, and so from a small business standpoint, the reason for doing Groupon, which I think, you know, can be sensible, it depends on your business, is, you know, if people who have never heard of your business come through the door and fall in love with it, and right. and if it's love at first sight, then you know, you've gotten something and you don't have to keep doing those coupons. But you're right that some businesses discover that actually that doesn't work, and this was not the best strategy for bringing those customers in.
Yeah. You refer in the book to a nascent enterprise called Locopedia. I tried to find it on the web this morning and was not able to. Tell us about
right.
that.
Right. It's nascent in the sense that we're trying to raise money for it. So we have some proposals sitting with foundations right now. So the we is the Schumacher Center for Local Economy.
Oh, wonderful people in Great Barrington.
In Great Barrington. So, and the whole idea of the Locopedia is that entrepreneurs, when they start businesses, they have many different needs. And some of those needs are met by existing entrepreneurship programs. So, you know, if somebody doesn't, for example, know how to create a balance sheet, you know, going to a class will teach you that. But my experience is that existing entrepreneurship programs are doing a pretty good job of meeting the generic needs of entrepreneurs. But when it comes to the specific needs within your sector, they're not so great. So, for example, if, you know, and I say this as someone who tried to do it, if you want to set up a small-scale chicken processing facility, probably the best way you're going to figure out whether this can work is to know about other successful small-scale chicken processors all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of database does not exist. And so the idea of the Locopedia is that for every sector imaginable, to assemble lists of successful small enterprises and contact people, and wherever possible, some details about the companies, so that entrepreneurs really see how small-scale success is possible. And the answer to that question, while you can you know, you can generically say to people, well, you need good marketing and you need good small-scale technology, need good management. Well, that's great, but what they really need to know is, here is the piece of equipment that really will make it work for you. Mm-hmm. Here is the way one organizes the capital labor mix. Here is the way you do branding as a way of making this work. So these are the kinds of things that I hope we can begin to communicate through the Locopedia. But mm-hmm. you're right, it doesn't exist yet. If there are any funders who are watching this video and wish to be in touch with me, Schumann@IGC.org. I'd love to talk with you.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. Here's my big strategic gift to this project is that it's great if a chicken processor can see what other chicken processors are doing. It's also great if that chicken processor can say, oh, this beef processor or this tofu processor came up with a really cool innovation that I think we can adapt. Some right. cross-industry pollination is something that you're probably going to want to build into this model.
Exactly, yeah. And in a way, you know, so last week I was working in Juneau. I was at something called the Innovation Summit, and one of the other keynote speakers was named Christian Kettles, and he works with Michael Porter teaching about clusters at MIT. And there's some interesting things about clusters. There's a lot of points about it that I'm skeptical about and critical of, but I think one of the good things about the cluster literature is that it understands that the close proximity of entrepreneurs in a given area, so to take the area we were talking about, meat processing and across sectors, is really an important part of innovation. And so, you know, the cluster theory says getting these people in one place is the best way of doing it. What Locopedia says is, in the absence of their being in one place, if we can connect them virtually, that would be very helpful too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes total sense. And because their innovations can come from many, many places. A lot of people don't realize that the drive-up restaurant window was something they stole from the banking industry.
Right. Right. Yes. And I would say they probably stole it from Photomat. So
no, it actually goes back to the to the 30s. There was no Photomat.
No Photomat in the 30s. All right. I think the first drive-up window I had in my childhood was Photomat. So.
Well, I don't want to take any more of your time here. I'll try to turn my video on again so that I can show your book cover, unless you've got it handy.
I must have it handy somewhere. Well, I have other books handy.
Well, I'll try mine here. Okay.
I have.
There's my first book, The Local Economy Solution, and the Excellent. Sound is holding, so that's good. And I think it would be nice to be able to work together because there's a lot of overlap in what we're trying to do. And I think a lot of fresh thinking that each of us can bring to the other's work as we go forward with our respective new books. Mine, again, is Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World, which is officially published on April 19th, 2016. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care, Shaw.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.